very influential on the left. And if we wanted to give that political repression of the 1940s and 50s a name, it should have been Hooverism after the FBI director J. Edgar Hoover. Mm.
You know, the movie Good Night and Good Luck, they showed real black and white footage of McCarthy. And test audiences thought he was too harsh, unrealistic, not realizing it was actual footage. And now you have Good Night and Good Luck on Broadway, George Clooney starring in it. And it is the financially most successful Broadway show we've seen, is going to be now for free on CNN in a few days. But the significance of that, what people feel today was a cartoon character, was in fact much harsher and sharper than people ever dreamed.
Yeah. He was beyond the pale because, like the current president, he had no guardrails, as it were.
Not to mention Roy Cohen, his sidekick in the hearings, who would later go on to mentor Donald Trump until, at the very end of his life, Donald Trump rejected him when he was dying of AIDS.
Exactly. So there are lots of similarities with the fact that there's this very aberrant character at the heart, or at the sort of public heart in of this repressive movement. But what we should have known in the 40s and 50s and should know now is it's not just a one-man show. It has been this moment of trying to crack down on dissent, constitutional dissent, free speech, the ability to say what Israel is doing in Gaza is a terrible thing. That is something that has been building up for decades. And that was the same thing during McCarthyism. There was a kind of network of right-wing activists, similar to groups today like the Heritage Society that brought us the 2025 Project blueprint for Trump's attack on the institutions of civil liberties and civil society, that has come to fruition since he entered the White House.
So, I mean, you speak as a Jewish author, active member of the American Association of University Professors. Would you say that the McCarthyism of yesteryear is the charges that President Trump, with his sidekick Elon Musk giving the Heil Hitler salute, charging anti-Semitism for what he's doing?
Anti-Semitism is a pretext. We know that. Trump has been all his life a racist, clearly befriending these fascist individuals and groups for years. And what we're seeing is a kind of a melding of Trump's own right-wing proclivities, reactionary proclivities, pro-fascist proclivities, with a long-term attempt within some pro-Zionist organizations to eliminate all support for Palestinian freedom and Palestinian liberation from American universities, in particular, but from within American society.
You have earlier this month, a federal judge, Jeffrey Crawford, ordering the release of Columbia University graduate Palestinian activist Mohsen Madawi from prison in Vermont. He was picked up by masked, hooded ICE agents at his naturalization interview in Vermont. He was beyond holding a green card. The judge writing in his ruling, quote, "Our nation's seen times like this before, especially during the Red Scare and Palmer raids of 1919, 1920, and during the McCarthy period of the 1950s. And I wanted to take it beyond that. You know that, you know, that we're not just talking about individual professors anymore. We're talking about current attacks being much broader. And you write that this interesting paradox, quote, despite higher education's much larger footprint within American society, today the academy is in a much weaker position to resist political intervention. Why is it weaker?
It's weaker for two reasons. One, because the state is stronger. The state does much more in with regard to higher education than it did in the 1950s. You know, it supports most important basic scientific research. It regulates things on campus with regard to, shall we say, diversity, equity, and inclusion, with trying to ensure that all Americans have a good shot at higher education. That was a push by the federal government. So you can see that the government is much more involved. It funds student loans. Most smaller universities without huge endowments rely on students who have to get federal loans in order to pay tuitions. So what he's doing by withdrawing federal money from higher education is essentially threatening to destroy American higher education today.
I wanted to turn to the clip of Secretary of State Marco Rubio speaking in March following the arrest of the Columbia graduate student, now graduated graduate student, albeit he was in jail in Louisiana when he got his diploma at Columbia, Mahmoud Khalil.
If you tell us when you apply, hi, I'm trying to get into the United States on a student visa, I am a big supporter of Hamas, a murderous, barbaric group that kidnaps children, that rapes teenage girls, that takes hostages, that allows them to die in captivity, that returns more bodies than live hostages. If you tell us that you are in favor of a group like this, and if you tell us when you apply for your visa, and by the way, I intend to come to your country as a student and rile up all kinds of anti-Jewish student, anti-Semitic activities, I intend to shut down your universities. If you told us all these things when you applied for a visa, we would deny your visa. I hope we would. If you actually end up doing that, once you're in this country on such a visa, we will revoke it. And if you end up having a green card, not citizenship, but a green card as a result of that visa while you're here in those activities, we're going to kick you out.
Of course, the Trump administration not proven any of this. And a number of students have been released from prison with very angry judges talking about where are the grounds for these people to be imprisoned. Mahmoud Khalil has been now imprisoned for 3 months as his little baby was born here in New York. If you can talk about what this leads to, these kind of harsh attacks when it comes to speech and when it comes to universities. You were just addressing the deans at Columbia University. Some compare Harvard not Harvard fighting back against the Trump administration and Columbia conceding and the pressure it's put on its students.
Yeah, this has been a constant in the history of American higher education to collaborate with political repression. Universities do not fight back. They didn't fight back during the McCarthy period. We're not fighting back until of this miracle. It really was a miracle, totally unexpected, of the president at Harvard saying, no, I cannot go along with what you were asking. And what they were asking—
The Jewish president at Harvard,
Jewish, right,
Alan Garber, who President Trump has accusing of anti-Semitism.
Well, of course, we're all anti-Semites, as long as we feel that maybe you shouldn't be killing babies in Gaza every day. But what we're seeing is the beginning of a pushback against what Trump is doing, what his entire apparatus of hoodlums, I think, is trying to do to the universities. And that wonderful quote you had from Secretary of State Rubio, when he said, you know, paraphrasing these supposed terrorists, that they wanted to shut down the universities. He's doing more to shut down the universities than probably anybody else in America at this moment.
Threatening to revoke the visas of all international students. What about the role of your organization, the AAUP, the American Association of University Professors? Right.
We are a group that is over 100 years old, and when we were founded, it was a period very much like today, where outsiders, politicians, and especially very wealthy business people on boards of trustees were interfering with what faculty members were saying and doing with regard to, at that point, there was a lot of labor unrest and attempts to create unions. And university professors were sort of saying, well, look at the working conditions under which American workers are being oppressed. Let's do something about industrial accidents and things like that. Today, we're seeing in every way, the federal government, state legislators, interfering with the academic work of university professors. And that is what my organization is trying to do, is to protect the integrity and the educational value of what goes on American campuses.
Do you hold out hope in this last minute we have together?
Yes. Because, unfortunately, we have no model we can follow from McCarthyism because there was no pushback. But today we're seeing people marching to commencement at Harvard, wearing labels saying, you know, enough is enough, President Trump. We're seeing huge crowds showing up to welcome Mohsen coming back from Vermont after having been picked up by ICE. We're seeing a growing movement within civil society that has to be maintained and has to be maintained for years. I mean, the damage that the Trump administration is doing is absolutely beyond the pale and has never, never been equaled in American life with regard to higher education. So we've got to get out there in the trenches and even begin to think some more about, okay, if they're not paying attention to the judges, if the Supreme Court folds, and let us pray that it does not, what do we have to do?
We're going to have to leave it there. Ellen Schrecker, author of Many Are the Crimes, McCarthyism in America. No Ivory Tower, McCarthyism and the Universities. Also the author of The Right to Learn, Resisting the Right-Wing Attack on Academic Freedom. We'll link to your piece in The Nation, headlined Worse Than McCarthyism, Universities in the Age of Trump, as well as Jelani Cobb's piece in The New Yorker that extensively quotes you, Ellen Schrecker, at democracynow.org. When we come back, President Trump vows to go to the Supreme Court to keep his tariffs in place, even though court after court is challenging them. We'll get an update from the Brennan Center in 30 seconds. Thanks so much for being with us.
Recoge solo tus ideas, levanta apaga tu mirada para todo lo que venga.
Me está llamando.
El día que amanece lento. Recoge solo tus ideas, levanta apaga tu mirada para todo lo que venga.
Me está llamando.
Semilla que va germinando, paciencia que el enfoque llega. El tiempo que flota en el aire, las horas al viento se entregan. Semilla que va germinando, paciencia que el enfoque llega. El tiempo que flota en el aire y el viento se entrega.
Me está llamando.
De a poco te zapas del miedo, un dedo tras otro lo sueltan. En tu pecho una llamarada que por dentro quema.
Me está llamando.
De a poco te zapas del miedo. Un dedo tras otro lo suelta. En tu pecho una llamarada que todo lo quema. Te está llamando. Y me está llamando. Óyelo.
Me está llamando.
Y un fuego que todo lo quema. Un fuego que todo lo quema. Responde que te está llamando. Responde que te está llamando. Un fuego que por donde quema. Un fuego que todo lo quema. Y un fuego que todo lo quema. Y un fuego que todo lo quema.
calling by Maku Sound System here at Democracy Now! Studios. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to Trump's sweeping global tariffs. After a whirlwind 24 hours that saw a federal appeals court Thursday temporarily reinstate the tariffs, just a day after the U.S. Court of International Trade blocked most of the tariffs, arguing Trump overstepped his presidential authority by invoking emergency powers. Prior to Thursday's appeals court order reinstating for a few minutes these tariffs, a federal court in Washington, D.C. also blocked Trump's tariffs, though that ruling won't go into effect for another 2 weeks. The Trump administration's vowed to bring the legal fight to the U.S. Supreme Court. In its ruling, the New York-based Court of International Trade said the U.S. Constitution gave Congress exclusive powers to regulate trade with other nations, and that a 1977 law cited by Trump to invoke the tariffs, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, did not give him the authority to levy the sweeping import taxes. President Trump denounced the attempts by the courts to block his tariffs in a lengthy Truth Social rant Thursday night that also targeted Leonard Leo, who, as a top member of the Conservative Federalist Society, played a vital role in influencing Trump's judicial picks during his first term, including the selection of three far-right Supreme Court justices. Trump wrote, quote, "Hopefully, the Supreme Court will reverse this horrible, country-threatening decision quickly and decisively. Backroom hustlers must not be allowed to destroy our nation." "I was new," Trump went on to say to Washington, "and it was suggested that I use the Federalist Society as a recommending source on judges. I did so openly and freely, but then realized that they were under the thumb of a real sleazebag named Leonard Leo, a bad person who in his own way probably hates America and obviously has his own separate ambitions." Trump went on to say, "I'm so disappointed in the Federalist Society because of the bad advice they gave me on numerous judicial nominations. This is something that cannot be forgotten," Trump wrote on social media and Truth Social. For more, we go to Washington, D.C., where we're joined by Elizabeth Goitein, co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, expert on the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, the law Trump has invoked to justify his global tariffs. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Elizabeth. Okay, if you can respond to everything. First, explain what this court is that overturned the tariffs, said you can't use this law, and then even who Leonard Leo and the Federalist Society, who many may be shocked that Trump has turned on, given he helped choose three of the Trump appointees who were confirmed to the Supreme Court.
Sure. So there are actually two courts that have now rejected Trump's attempt to use emergency powers to essentially bypass Congress and impose worldwide tariffs. One of those courts is a regular federal district court here in Washington, D.C., and another court is called the Court of International Trade, which is a specialized federal court that hears challenges to laws involving trade or customs. The Court of International Trade heard the case with a three-judge panel. So we now have had four different judges, two of whom were appointed by Republican presidents, including one Trump appointee, and two of whom were appointed by a Democratic president. And all of them, so the Court of International Trade panel was unanimous, held that Trump exceeded the authority provided to him under law by imposing these tariffs.
And so go more deeply into this 1977 law and what it means to invoke an emergency.
Sure. The law is called the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, or IEEPA. And it is one of the 150 laws that become available when the president declares a national emergency. IEEPA requires the president not only to declare a national emergency, but also the powers that are available under IEEPA have to be used to deal with an unusual and extraordinary threat to the national security, foreign policy, or economy of the United States, and they cannot be used for any other reason. IEEPA has historically been used to impose economic sanctions against hostile foreign actors. It forms the basis for dozens of existing sanctions regimes, including our sanctions against Iran, North Korea, Venezuela, et cetera. But it has never previously been used to impose tariffs. And that is because while IEEPA includes a long list of powers that the president can exercise, that list does not include the words tariffs, taxes, or duties. So the government is instead arguing that language in IEEPA that allows the president to regulate economic transactions, including imports and exports, should be read to sort of impliedly authorize tariffs against every country in the world.
Let me ask
and that's,
you.
That is what the courts rejected.
The three-judge panel of the trade court also blocked a separate set of tariffs against China, Mexico, and Canada, which the Trump administration had imposed over what it claimed was a flow of illicit drugs and undocumented immigrants into the United States.
Right. And there was actually a separate reasoning for blocking those tariffs. So when it came to the worldwide tariffs, essentially what the court said is that the government was claiming unlimited power to impose whatever tariffs that the president thought would be appropriate. And that was such a massive sort of takeover of the powers that the Constitution gives to Congress. So Congress, under Article 1, has the authority. In fact, it's the first power listed under Congress's powers to impose tariffs. And if you read IEEPA to allow the president to make up his own mind about what tariffs should be imposed on what countries, that would be unconstitutionally transferring Congress's power to the president. The fentanyl tariffs that you mentioned against China, Mexico, and Canada were more limited. And so there was a different argument that was made in that case. What the plaintiffs argued was that under IEEPA, the powers have to be exercised to deal with an unusual or extraordinary threat, and that the tariffs in this case were such a total mismatch to the threat that had been identified, the threats of fentanyl trafficking and human trafficking and illegal immigration, that it just didn't meet the criteria for IEEPA.
So
now in this case,
I'm going to interrupt. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, this is really important, which is why I'm not letting you interrupt me yet. What the government argued in this case was that no court can question the president's decision that his actions under IEEPA are dealing with an unusual and extraordinary threat. And the Court of International Trade rejected this claim entirely. The court said that these criteria in the statute are clear and that the courts are capable of interpreting and applying them, and that the supremacy of the law requires that courts must be able to intervene when a president acts outside of the law. So that was a very important part of the ruling that will have salience far beyond this immediate case.
So you have Trump officials calling this a judicial coup. They're going to take it to the Supreme Court. What do you see happening?
Well, I think it might take a little while because there are several other lawsuits pending across the country on the tariffs, and there will be decisions in the lower courts, and then they will go up to the appellate courts. The appellate courts will have their chance to rule. Yes, this is headed towards the Supreme Court in the next term for the Supreme Court. I don't think anyone can predict exactly what will happen, but I will point out that one of the arguments reasons that the Court of International Trade gave for holding that IEEPA does not authorize tariffs was because such a reading of IEEPA would violate the major questions doctrine. And that is a doctrine that the Supreme Court has really embraced in these last few years. Under this doctrine, any executive branch actions that have major political or economic significance must be clearly authorized by Congress. It has to be explicit. It cannot be a vague or ambiguous provision that is being interpreted to grant that power. That is certainly the case with the government's interpretation of IEEPA. So there's a strong argument on a based on a doctrine that the Supreme Court has very much endorsed.
And before the Supreme Court, could the tariffs be blocked again? We just have 20 seconds.
Yes, it is possible. It's also possible, and I would argue probably likely, that the courts will continue to stay these decisions and allow the tariffs to go forward pending appeal. But I wouldn't bet a lot of money on that. It's very unpredictable.
Elizabeth Goitein, I want to thank you so much for being with us, co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. Next up, Reagan attorney Bruce Fein on the slew of pardons Trump has issued this week. Back in 20 seconds.
I'll wave a history, riding in a wave. I'll wave a history.
History by Downtown Boys performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show with a slew of pardons President Trump has issued, many this past week. In one case, Trump pardoned Scott Jenkins, a former Virginia sheriff and longtime Trump supporter, convicted on corruption charges after undercover video showed he accepted over $75,000 in bribes. In another case, Trump pardoned the former reality show couple, Todd and Julie Chrisley, after they were sentenced to long prison terms for evading taxes and defrauding banks of more than $30 million. The couple's daughter helped campaign for Trump. She requested the appeal on Fox News. This comes as Trump loyalist Ed Martin has a new role as the Justice Department's pardon attorney after he failed to win Senate approval to become District of Columbia's top prosecutor. For more, we go to Washington, D.C. We're joined by Bruce Fein, constitutional lawyer, former associate deputy attorney general, and general counsel of the Federal Communications Commission under President Ronald Reagan, author of Constitutional Peril, The Life and Death Struggle for Our Constitution and Democracy. Bruce, thanks so much for joining us. Why don't you go through these pardons with us? Talk about the Virginia sheriff. Talk about the reality TV couple, what they were in prison for and what it means that they've been freed, not to mention fines worth millions of dollars being forgiven.
Well, in the two cases you mentioned, the sheriff was convicted of basically using his office to raise money through bribes, $75,000, to give favors to friends. The other case concerned tax evasion and fraud, the kinds of crimes that Mr. Trump himself has been under attack for. I think that if you look in the broader sense, Mr. Trump is trying to create an aura of incredulity about the legitimacy of the criminal justice system, at least with regard to the pardons of these slew of white-collar offenses, and sometimes their political allies as well. We just learned today in the newspapers a former congressman, former governor of Connecticut, also pardoned. And I think that Mr. Trump recognizes that he's losing overwhelmingly in the courts now, and that's why he's even turning on the Federalist Society and Leonard Leo, because he believes when he loses in the United States Supreme Court, he's going to need a political reason for why he's losing. And he's trying to cast aspersion, I believe, on the legitimacy of the entire justice system. That's why these pardons are not indiscriminate, because they're targeted to help people who are politically his supporters, raise money for him or otherwise, and which is very dangerous. I want to add this. The framers understood the possibility that the pardon power would be abused. There was an exchange in the Virginia ratification debate between James Madison and George Mason. And Mr. Madison, when Mr. Mason said, well, what if the president uses his pardon power to help his political friends? That could be very, very dangerous. Why are we endowing the president with such pardon power? And Mr. Madison said, well, if the president uses pardons to help his political friends or personal friends, certainly the House will impeach and he will be removed from Congress. Because it's very difficult for an individual citizen, you or me have standing to challenge a pardon. Unfortunately, Congress has turned into an inkblot. It has no spine. And so that remedy is gone, which I think underscores the importance, if we're going to have any kind of pushback, of public opinion saying we need the law to be enforced even-handedly.
I want to ask you about Paul Walczak. In April, President Trump pardoned him, the Florida healthcare executive convicted of tax evasion for...